Hello and welcome to the September 8, 2015 edition of the Odelay Show with C.G. Braswell. Today's editorial is about social justice, specifically regarding the issue of race. It is a hot-button topic. Please remember that I am trying to help address the subject by way of useful dialogue in an attempt to build common ground and provide a constructive perspective. From my vantage, the working press has been giving much lip service to recent use of unnecessary force, violence, and indiscriminate killing against people of color in various locations throughout the United States. I cannot say what mainstream media is doing about such stories because I stopped subscribing to them years ago, and I do my best to weed out content that is biased and unreliable from my input vectors. So, as a media scholar, I wonder if the increased attention to the matter is a result of changes in media technology and its applications, or statistical increases in certain kinds of crime. I suspect the answer is both. Strongly suspect. I would, at a blush, affirm it. Based on the weather. Canadian cultural studies professor Henry Giroux of the McMaster University faculty in Ontario, in his paper titled "The Racist Killing Fields in America, The Death of Sandra Bland," writes the following. This is a quote. "The killing of black youth by the police is no longer a routine affair, a norm that stretches back to slavery. On the contrary, it now appears to have become both a spectacle and a sport in America. Of course, there has been an unbroken line of terror and violence waged against black people since slavery." Unfortunately, Professor Giroux is correct. It is important to bear in mind the greater historical context of constitutional transgression and violence related to civil rights implementation, historical slavery in the South, abolition, assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, black codes, Jim Crow, and resistance to integration, which is still going on. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. Regarding the death of Sandra Bland, it does not surprise me that law enforcement officials in Waller County, Texas, did not recognize the legitimacy of a young black woman's political speech during a traffic stop for essentially no reason, failing to signal a lane change. The city where I grew up is in that general area. Politically and sociologically, the East Texas and South Central Texas regions are, unfortunately, examples of places where desegregation is still not a harmonious success story. It's a separate piece at best, and that's really a PC way to say it. It was and still is agricultural area, and there were and of course still are many blacks, and the old white money, however, is still there and still incumbent to local political power, which is at least hip deep. And when I say there, when I was there in my youth and young adulthood, the police were certainly no exception to that face of the local state. It was my experience that, you know, upon learning that such was the reality of one's surroundings, one immediately understood that it was a fool's errand to get institutionally crossways with the train tracks of deep-seated institutionalized hatred that is racism, are a dangerous thing for anyone to stand on, regardless of one's color. I was a little white urban hippie kid, and I understand, skateboard kid, and I understand now that to many, I might as well have been black as far as local authorities were concerned. And I don't know what they, and the culture, and I don't know what they think about journalists because I wasn't one then, and I don't live there anymore. So regarding organizational policy for civil police, it tends to be a local matter. And that's why local rules in a given court venue are always so important. Therefore, Any evident biases or inclinations are typically a reflection of local policy, written or unwritten. So to have, I mean, the case law that I learned in college when I was taking constitutional law, I mean, you know, where it, you know, when it's okay to use for, you know, a citizen to use lethal force and someone egresses their property. And I can think back to where these precedent-setting cases in the states, you know, where they occurred. A lot of the stuff that was happening in the Old South was, you know, as stated, well, this is, you know, can you shoot someone on the egress of their home? You know, but when you think about the greater context, well, this was in, you think about what city, what town, what state it was in and when, then there's more implications there. And then you can read more into the legal opinions in the high courts. So, any evident biases or inclinations are typically a reflection of local policy, written or unwritten. So, to have a discussion about law enforcement policy, we have to keep that in mind. And at the local level, the solution to hand would seem to be through grassroots efforts and efforts at education towards tolerance and increasing the constituency's wherewithal regarding civil rights. We had to be careful about trying people in the press. If that's the only venue that's left, then go ahead. And as with signs following, go ahead. Ideally, you have an egalitarian, democratic, self-governing situation out in any city, whether it's in the Old South or not, that reflects the political will of the actual constituency. And let those grand juries handle it. That's a jury of your peers. What often seems to evidently historically been happening, though, is that you get a ruling cabal of a minority white, okay, a government, and that's not reflective of the civil rights that are affirmed in the governing documents of law of the land. There's a difference. Democracy, self-government is a critical key aspect of democracy. Locally, but it has to be done right. You can't call it that, and then it's not that, and then that's sufficient. So at the local level, the solution to hand would seem to be through grassroots efforts, the efforts at education towards tolerance and increasing the constituency's wherewithal regarding civil rights. In my town now, in the great southwestern United States, the local city police are operating among a relatively low crime rate for an urban jurisdiction. It's a smaller city than where I grew up, and it's not a metro area. It's an urban hub in a more generally rural, very large rural sector of the state. But the urban hub here has a relatively low crime rate for urban jurisdictions in the United States, and this is a prominent military institution nearby, and so there ends up being a large population of the citizenry and local leadership who are from all over the place, the world, not just all over the continent, and they have career training, so they have a more realistic expectation, like, of it doesn't shock the conscience when they see a black guy, you know, or whatever. Like sometimes is the case in more and less culturally affluent areas where there's, you know, some old political structures been sitting there like a rook on a fence for a long time. But anyway, there ends up here because of the institution, people who have career training in civics and law and paramilitary and kind of worldly travels. On the other hand, this county is predominantly rural, as I said, and is larger than Delaware, and it borders Mexico to the south, and it comprises an historical overland smuggling route because of its remoteness and forbidding terrain in the middle of nowhere. And violent crime in this county is said to occur at a rate above the national average. That's countywide. It's not the urban area, which has a lower rate with respect to the mean average for urban areas. And, of course, these considerations bring us right up to a dialogue about federal immigration policy and the war on drugs. And those are kinds of law enforcement, too. Full stop. So any policy related to the war on drugs is occurring in your name. because we are a self-governing nation and you are incumbent as a citizen. Likewise, any policy regarding federal immigration is occurring in your name, even if it occurs out of state. After college, my first day job was a government reporter and police beat reporter for the local newspaper here in this same area of Southern Arizona. I was there for 4 years. I since moved away and have come back to the general area. I went back to Texas for a while, to Houston, for several years. What was that, 2008 to 2013? In 5 years, I was back in Texas, and I came back here a couple years ago. And I was in that position at the newspaper for 4 years full-time, and I not only did I, as a government and police beat reporter, and I learned a lot about how city and government, county governments function, as well as interact with federal agencies. So I also had a close extended look under the hood being on the police beat. I had a close extended look under the hood at law enforcement profession, as well as various other types of first responders. It has helped my fiction writing. I promise you, it has also helped, you know, my understanding and kind of enfranchisement, if you will, in the criminal justice system. And as a journalist, that experience has proven to be extremely useful to me because I am a forensic professional in my own right. I mean, I am an investigator. Currently in the throes of fleshing out a thesis proposal, canvassing the literature for graduate school applications. You know, that's forensic work too. You know, in contact with a guy on death row, I had a little trouble, as I mentioned earlier, coming up as a youth, and I wasn't part of the establishment stripe, if you will, through no fault of my parents. And so I got a view of the criminal justice system from that vantage as well when I was a kid, basically. Anyway, being a police beat reporter and government reporter helped me kind of know really what's realistic and what isn't. You know, it's not just a television drama-based experience regarding how I think that law enforcement has to be. It's important to point out, and I have said this before on this program, that the world takes or gives all kinds of people. There are good cops and bad cops. There are good journalists and bad journalists. There are good and bad. It's a question of morals when you think of it in terms of good and bad, hot, cold, ouch, not ouch. Teach a toddler how to survive. Ethics. The point is what it evolves into, and the point is that local policies, whether right or wrong, determine the face and mettle of a local police agency. The police in my area seem to be pretty squared away, and it doesn't surprise me here, out here in South Arizona, doesn't surprise me considering the military presence here. It's different up in Phoenix. That's a huge metropolitan area. There's a lot of political lightning rodness happening up there with the sheriff of Maricopa County. When you're the sheriff of a major metropolitan area like that, you necessarily are sitting right on the ley line of full-blown national politics. It's different down here. This is a small town. It's army town. Peace officers are sworn to uphold the Constitution, but when the criteria for the office becomes a matter of, for example, who you know or who you are to get the job, then it like what can also happen in backwaters, then it is more difficult to enforce egalitarian constitutional law or civil rights with a straight face. And the point is that it is hard work by definition, and thankless. It's true. And the integrity of law enforcement relies upon having quality applicants, rigorous application processes, and robust training. And at any moment when you have a police officer who doesn't understand their primary role as a public servant and their primary rights and responsibilities that are exactly the same restrictions and obligations that any other citizen in good standing would have, even if they weren't a trained police officer, the ethics of it are the same in terms of civil rights. You got to help people if you can and are able. And if you don't, you omit to do so at your own peril. And you can't step on people's civil rights. Doesn't matter what you're wearing or who told you you could. Geographically speaking, much or most jurisdictional right-of-way in the United States is not constituent to any. And I won't speak for any police, not one, not all of them. They speak for themselves. They, you know, any police officer ought to be well-versed in this sort of thing. Geographic, and so they don't need me to speak for them. or him or her, or whoever. And geographically, this is more or less an educational function, as I'm a member of the media, or I'm a journalist, or a reporter. Geographically speaking, much or most jurisdictional right-of-way in the United States is not constituent to any municipal police department, moreover. And in essentially all such rural areas, the elective enforcement of laws or protection of civil rights really does come down to the barest common denominator of a United States citizen's obligations and rights. As a citizen, this exemplifies why conversations about firearms and law enforcement policy becomes intractable when taken from a sweeping national vantage. It has to be a local policy because local self-governance is a key to democracy, one, and what's good in the, you know, where there are 30,000 people per square mile is not going to translate seamlessly to where there is one horse and, you know, one old guy, one old farmer per, you know, per 30 miles. Of course, unconstitutional transgressions of civil liberties or civil rights are not protected. And that is the guarantee, for example, you could say this, the guarantee clause of the Constitution does not guarantee to each state a republican form of government that disregards the Bill of Rights as a function. I talk a lot about, I mean, essentially the guarantee clause is, all right, you govern yourself, you use all the tools that are there in the federal toolkit, you're welcome to. All those checks and balances, it works. But you can't have painted your wagon all the right colors and then just do it to go around and just beat up black people or kill fags or whatever it is that, you know, or commit crimes, that is to say, violate people's civil rights. You can't do it. And everybody has an obligation or certainly an opportunity and a right to stand up and say, you can't do that. I mean, that is within the purview. All people can, if they want to, intercede. When you see civil rights being traversed. And that's why, I mean, by and large, you know, police are supposed to know this. Typically, they do. Not everywhere, not every agency. But there's a huge, I mean, it's not an educated and an informed police officer knows better, you know, because it's dangerous, you know. I mean, that's justifiable, you know. So it's justifiable to intercede against a police officer who is transgressing civil rights. It, you know, so, and it would be my guess that most of them know that. And the ones that I do, and I'm not every man, and my friends aren't everybody, but I appear to know that. And that's good, you know. It protects your privacy, protects your rights. That's an executive check that is in play. I talk a lot about the currency as being representative of the constitutionally vested executive powers, which are enjoyed by all United States citizens in good standing. Okay? Everybody has the same access to the executive protocol cognitively or in the marketplace that the executive, the American executive office is incumbent to. So the dollar, you know, that gives you, that's a tool that you have. The dollar means something different in Phoenix than it does to the people down here near the border. And then again, it means something altogether different to the people on the East Coast. And there certainly is much common ground, but enforcing the political will of extra local actuaries in a local marketplace can be a recipe for trouble. And however, when it's relevant, there is an obligation, as I've said, to enforce it from afar. If you have to, ideally, somebody local would see that there's something going on wrong and would understand their rights as Americans. And that's when we get into constitutional law at the local level. Even a hate group has a First Amendment right to peaceably assemble. But a hate group that is unelectable in its regions of historical influence, for example, is not and legitimately incumbent to power in state government. And that's unconstitutional. I've kind of covered the subject earlier when talking about juries, grand juries. But that's what the Confederate battle flag means in the sense when it's hot, flying from the public buildings in the Old South. So an individual has a protected right to fly such a flag in order to demonstrate their own hatred. Because it's freedom, say, you know, it's his freedom of speech. But a group governing on behalf of the people don't have that same protection. That's an unconstitutional violation of civil liberties if that occurs. You know, the latter example. And that's one, if not the only, example of the term official capacity that has any legitimate traction. It's a restriction, not the converse, official capacity to go commit atrocities. All other examples of the concept of official capacity, such as which are would be typically used historically to justify transgressions of civil rights, are legal fictions. The official capacity, when it's of relevance, means that you can't go and, you know, speak for others in doing so, or, you know, violate the rights of others in the name of others. A parallel argument goes like this. A state cannot discriminate against people by sanctioning only one sort of civil union. Individuals or groups of people have the right to couple with, dwell with, and assemble with whom they prefer in the confines of the laws that govern, and as long as they don't transgress people's civil rights, harm the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of others peaceably. So a state cannot discriminate against people by sanctioning only one sort of civil union. Individuals or groups of people have the right to couple with, dwell with, and assemble with whom they prefer, but they may not incorporate their political will at the public or state level in order to secularize their bias through government policy. And that would be and is unconstitutional, but it happens, and it describes in general how institutional discrimination, one way, how institutional discrimination, such as racism, manifests at the government or public level, such as among police personnel. In light of the fact that the world is drastically changing fastly, it is important to remember all of these rules about how we are supposed to act in public and how we are supposed to treat other people and about what can, has, and could still go wrong in America and in the world. Currently, people are organizing in order to hunker down for the big one, the long winter. And these days, more so than ever, to cross someone based on principle may be viewed in their mind as you're interfering with their beeline towards survival, because people's reality is very widely, so there's risk there. Then again, it's always been the end times for somebody, and there's always... So be cool and stay calm and be polite. There are solvent opinions, but the clock is ticking. Solvent options, but the clock is ticking. Philosophers call our current era the Anthropocene, describing the confluence of geological time and human time, beginning with the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century and continuing on through the post-nuclear era. Global population continues to climb, which has direct implications for population management, which has implications, therefore, for law enforcement. Local civil law enforcement everywhere. Historically, the law of the sea has been the prevailing current for keeping numbers in check for overcrowded populations, either global or otherwise, and it still is that way in most places on Earth. Currently, just to name a few, there are refugee crises in South America, Europe, Middle East, and frankly, all over the United States. That is, you don't have to leave the states to see it. Every major United States city has huge homeless populations. The American prison population is enormous and growing, full of people with mental health problems, as are our streets. Increasingly privatized and capitalized prison industrial complex. There are desperate people everywhere all over the world, and human trafficking is rampant worldwide, and much of the market for it is here in the United States. Many people are behaving with creating a demand for it. Many people are for sex slaves. Many people are behaving with the impunity reserved for the end of times indeed. And that's kind of, I think that's part of the ontology for that sort of behavior, is a certain hopelessness or fatalist disposition. So again, I say it's always been the end of times, and it always is the end of times for some people, particularly people who are behaving this way. It's a self-feeding loop. United States policy decisions, foreign and domestic, at this critical time are the blueprint, the example of secular morality for the whole world. We need to think about it realistically and carefully. We do not want to be the pessimistic engineer throwing in the towel at this critical moment in time. The answers rely on correctional reform and public mental health services and egalitarian health care. The answers include getting off of the fossil fuels for powering our grids so that the cities of the 21st century and beyond are sustainable realms of technological pride and opportunity and healthiness, and not hydrocarbonated marketplace constructs which perpetuate inequities among socioeconomic strata and hedge on the wanton destruction of finite resources. The answer lies in the reform of grocery logistics from a grassroots level into a sustainable human slot in the planet's food chain, and away from the agrologistics, which treat both non-human animals and their unknowing consumers as property and tools for unsustainable profiteering, which is a kind of racketeering, which is a crime. And it does not go without, but that's subordinate to the greater argument, the criminal profiteering is subordinate to the greater argument of treating people and animals as property and being somewhat extremely draconian and unsustainable, regardless of whether it's codified as in the racketeering influence and corrupt organization statute. But anyway, for Americans, this means we have to mobilize, or your local criminal code. For Americans, this means we have to mobilize and be continually prepared for another gargantuan effort. The playing field is changed, and we have to deal with it, and there are more refined things expected of us than just heading for the hills. And we build this whole rock out with solar cells, the world around, and go. And then maybe the girls over at Proxima Centauri will finally talk to us in the lunchroom and quit eating animals. Yes, you are a part of the living planet and sun, and until you knock it off, you're killing yourself to live. Part of the same system, is like eating your own foot off. And in the words of Detective Frank Thorne, Soylent Green is people. People. It may seem like I have gone rather far afield from the issue of law enforcement and racial justice, but in this essay, but in light of the facts that, number one, all law enforcement is actually a local issue, because when done from afar, it's called something else. It's certainly not effective, and it's not citizen-on-citizen dialogue and networking and implementation. And number two, all law enforcement is local. And number two, it's what some piece of paper on some other desk in some other state has to say about it is about as irrelevant as it can possibly be when it comes right down to public law enforcement. Number two, it's a sociological issue, and that means that the roots and remedies are far-reaching and require an interdisciplinary approach. To give a few key words specific to the issue of racial justice, some of the issues discussed, for example, in my urban politics classes while I was an undergraduate come to mind. Manipulation of real estate markets to price people out of otherwise empty housing. Building out while there sit empty houses and homeless people. For example, mortgage and finance fraud, gentrification, lease buyouts, and so-called white flight, environmental racism, budget cuts to public education and other social services, food deserts, lack of access to public parks, open green space, affordable transportation, the prison industrial complex, the war on drugs, and other written or unwritten policies that amount to ostensible black codes. Can we name what is blocking progress towards fixing these issues, or why are we seemingly in retrograde, such as with the Voting Rights Act having been gutted by the United States Supreme Court in Shelby County versus Holder in 2013, it happened. The Roberts Court. Quoting UC Irvine sociologist Carol Glasser, oppressions are interlocking and mutually reinforcing with an overarching system of domination. So, beyond isolating the racial parameters of social justice, other social constructs are interrelated with the issue of social justice, such as sex and gender roles, ecology and ecofeminism, global economics, various certain and sundry ethical problems inherent to capitalism as it's currently incarnated. Just briefly say, you don't want to start cloning something until you have perfected it. That is to say, you don't want your unless your operation is so wonderfully streamlined and actually is an ambient benefit holistically, transcendentally to the marketplace and all of its logistical interactions in the at-large web, then you shouldn't be, it shouldn't be capitalized. It shouldn't be generating a profit. If what your operation is doing is generating a profit, it better also be just good for people generally to sit, stand around you while you work. Okay? So if you're making money off something, you have to have the system perfected in terms of your context of it. Unfortunately, that's not how capitalism as is currently defined or is apparently working. Maybe it is. I mean, they're in the utopian sense, and I don't say that tongue-in-cheek. Where it works, it works. Where people have figured out, it's been figured out. There are operations that are hitting on all eight cylinders right now, and they're good for everybody just because of the sheer fact that they're there, even people who don't know it. Often, though, the big dinosaurs, if you will, in the capitalist marketplace are turning profits, but they're not only haven't they perfected their role in the marketplace, and not only aren't they beneficial ambiently to the marketplace at large, they're actually not only bad for the marketplace, but they're bad for the actual geography that sustains it currently. You know, eventually you're going to run out of little foreign kids to sell as sex slaves. Eventually you're going to run out of the blood of the earth to sell as fuel for plastics and refineries. You know, eventually you're gonna cut down all the forests and you're gonna kill all the people. That crap doesn't need to be capitalized. It's not mature. Just put it very lightly. Anyway, the problem is occurring on a global scale. In the United States, the ideal is advertised as one of an egalitarian society, which by its nature creates a competitive marketplace. However, there is much evidence of class warfare, anti-intellectualism, general racketeering, and other in bad faith and harmfully selfish or unkind operations in the marketplace at large. There are ethical disconnects between the philosophical foundations of our nation and the actuality of daily life. Separation of church and state does not prevent defining constitutional violations of civil rights as immoral. And in the public sphere, it does not prevent a system from rewarding ethical operators and weeding out hate-based ones. Be honest. Have you ever traveled for vegan food? Have you ever planned a vacation around vegan food finds? Do you take photos of your food and dream of your next meal and sharing it on social media? Oh, yeah. Then you're going to love this. Check out this newly released memoir, Will Travel for Vegan Food, a young woman's solo van-dwelling mission to break free, find food, and make love, written by Kristen Lajeunesse. In it, Kristen explores the personal side of a two-year-long journey wherein she set out to eat at every single vegan restaurant, cafe, food truck, and eatery she could find in the United States while living out of a van and entirely off of donations. Even though her project blogged maintained food-related updates throughout the journey, Kristen's memoir is about things that she never dared share publicly until now, including people she met, how the journey quite literally changed her life, and even some romantic encounters. Dad, if you're listening, skip chapter 8, she says. Listen to your daughter. Pick up a copy of Will Travel for Vegan Food on Amazon.com or on veganpublishers.com. Also, see where Kristen is now by following at her Will Travel for Vegan Food social media pages and her blog at WTFveganFood.com. That's WTFveganFood.com. That solves it for this September 8, 2015 edition of the Odelay Show with C.G. Braiswell. Thank you to the Odelay Show's former guest and my friend and the author, Kristen Lajeunesse of Will Travel for Vegan Food, for her support as well. The show is also brought to you by independent publisher Braiswell Communications, my company, and its latest nonfiction book production, Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, by yours truly, C.G. Braiswell, which is available in hard copy at www.fusepowder.com. That's FUSEPOWDER.com. And in ebook format through one of your favorite online book retailers. Also, look for Private Eye Denver Days Pizza Noir series of hard-boiled sci-fi detective novels. Novels. Available in hard copy at www.denverday.com. That's DENVERDAY.com. And in ebook format as well. Pizza Noir Book 2, Alpha Taxonomy, is currently in production and coming soon. I'm waiting on the proof to denverday.com, and also will be available online in ebook format. That's it for the show. Good day. Oh, contact me at 518-400-2729 for your small publishing needs, for your editorial input, and for if you would like to be mentioned, as was in this show, Miss Lajeunesse. So operation was mentioned. If you want to give such in-kind support as that to the Odelay Show and my journalistic efforts, then feel free to do call, say, write letters, and the like. Again, that's it for September 8.